Before we get into today's episode, we want to tell you about another show from the team behind The Final Hours, Hidden History with Dr. Harini Bhatt.
Every Monday, Dr. Bhatt goes where history gets uncomfortable. Vanished civilizations, doomsday prophecies, paranormal phenomena, and events that science still can't fully explain.
She'll give you historical context, break down the science, and even interrogate the supernatural, and ask, what if it happened today?
Hidden History drops every Monday. Follow now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen so you never miss a mystery.
This is Crime House.
You're squinting at security footage from inside a gas station convenience store located somewhere off I-5 in Brooks, Oregon. The timestamp tells you it's just before 1 a.m. on March 13th, 2000. Now, watch the front door.
A young woman with light brown hair and a hat walks in. She drops something, picks it up, and then wanders out of frame. When she gets to the counter, she hands something to the cashier and pays for it. Then the woman turns, steps back from the register, and deliberately looks out the front door, back at the parking lot. She does a double take and looks again. The camera outside the store isn't working, so there's no way to tell what she's seeing. But something out there has caught her attention. A moment later, she turns back to the cashier, takes her receipt, and walks out into the night. She gets back in her white Jeep Cherokee and pulls out onto the highway heading north.
Her name is Leah Roberts. She's 23 years old. And that's the last confirmed footage of her alive.
Every year, over 500,000 people go missing, and that's just in the United States alone. Most of those stories barely get a headline. Some don't even get a flyer or a tip line. And when cases do get media attention, we usually only get the broad strokes.
But for those of us who have lived these true crime cases, we know the devil's in the details. This is The Final Hours, a Crime House original powered by Pave Studios. I'm Sarah Turney.
And I'm Courtney Nicole. Every Monday, Sarah and I will be looking at the final hours of someone's disappearance, the small, seemingly mundane moments to see if there was anything hiding in plain sight.
Looking back at all those last conversations, connections, and choices is critical, and it could be the key to unlocking it all. Each episode, I'll offer insight on what those close to the victim might have been going through. And Courtney will use her expertise to give more context into the crime scene, the red flags, and the investigation itself. And we want to thank you all for being a part of the Crime House community. Please rate, review, and follow the show. And for ad-free access to every episode, subscribe to Crime House Plus on Apple Podcasts.
Today, we're discussing the disappearance of 23-year-old Leah Roberts. In March of 2000, Leah left her home in Durham, North Carolina, on an unexpected cross-country road trip. She left behind a cryptic note and enough cash to cover a month's rent. 9 days later, her Jeep was found in Washington State, but Leah wasn't in it. Despite the strange stories of her final encounters, Leah's whereabouts are still a mystery, 26 years later.
It's March of 2000. 23-year-old Leah Roberts has spent her entire life in what North Carolina locals call the Research Triangle, an area that includes the cities of Durham, Raleigh, and Chapel Hill. Currently, she's living in Raleigh, in an apartment off campus at North Carolina State University, where she's been studying. Leah's known for being a good friend, creative thinker, and a free spirit. She moves through the world with an artist's eye as a photographer, a poet, and an amateur guitar player. She also loves listening to live music, smoking cigarettes, cuddling her cat Bee, and reading Jack Kerouac. Leah's sweet, easygoing personality puts people at ease the moment they meet her. That's how she landed a close-knit group of friends at NC State, where she enrolled to study anthropology and Spanish. Leah can often be found in a local coffee shop called Cup of Joe. The baristas call her Double Cap Girl, since she orders a double cappuccino every morning. She used to spend her days studying there, but lately she's only journaling and rereading Kerouac novels, because for reasons unclear to her family and friends, Leah dropped out of college just a few weeks ago. It's an odd choice considering she was about to graduate in May, but maybe it's because the last few years haven't been kind to Leah. She survived things that would be difficult for most people to navigate. Her childhood, fortunately, was stable and happy. She grew up in Durham, about 15 miles from NC State. She always got along well with her older siblings, Heath and Kara, and they were all still close with her parents, Nancy and Stansel. But in 1994, that stability started to crack when Leah was 17 years old. Stansel was diagnosed with a life-threatening respiratory disease. As he fought through his illness, the family rallied around him. They were so focused on watching over Stansel that none of them saw their mother Nancy's health deteriorating as well. Then, in February of 1997, just as Leah was finding her footing at NC State, her mother died from heart disease. Leah was 20 years old. She had just watched her father's health begin to fail, and now her mother was gone. Her life had been changed forever.
Leah took some time off from school after losing her mother, but true to form, she picked herself back up and returned to NC State in the fall of 1998. Then, almost immediately afterwards, the universe dealt her another blow. While Leah was driving, a truck pulled out right in front of her and she couldn't stop in time. The accident left Leah with a punctured lung and a shattered femur. Surgeons implanted a metal rod in her leg to help it heal. She later told her sister Kara that in the moments just before the crash, she felt like she was going to die. But she didn't. And when she came out the other side, she felt the need to live life to its fullest.
And that renewed energy took her places. In the spring of 1999, she did a semester abroad in Spain, a perfect location to further her education in Spanish and anthropology. Then, bitten by the travel bug, Leah signed up for a field study program in Costa Rica over the summer. But then, in March of 1999, her father's condition worsened. When Stansel was hospitalized, Leah took another break from college to spend time with him. Less than a month later, Stansel Roberts passed away. At just 22 years old, Leah was now an orphan.
What happened next says a lot about who Leah was. 3 weeks after her dad's passing, Leah was scheduled to leave for that field study program in Costa Rica. Most people would have canceled, but Leah decided to continue with her plan. Friends who visited her over the summer were a bit confused by her decision to still go on her trip. She didn't seem to be grieving the loss of her father in the way they imagined she would. But rather than shutting down, as one might expect, Leah was opening up. She seemed to be searching for a new way to live her life, one that was unique from the way everyone else lived theirs.
I feel like everybody grieves differently, and sometimes these major losses, especially when you have two so close together, they can kind of have this delayed effect sometimes. I mean, long story short, everybody's different, and as long as you're not hurting yourself or others, I think that there's really no wrong way to grieve.
Yeah, I 100% agree. There really is no right or wrong way. And honestly, I feel like Leah's choice of like wanting to like reinvent herself, I feel like that's something to admire. You know, instead of like shutting down, there's nothing wrong with that either. I just feel like it's a good way, you know, like you said, as long as you're not hurting anybody, it's a kind of a good way to like look forward to something in the midst of losing both of your parents and going through just such a horrific car accident as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, sometimes when you lose someone, I feel like it compels you to like live life even harder, right? To travel more, to do the thing you've always been putting off. I think sometimes it just teaches you like how precious life really is and makes you want to live it to the fullest, right? And again, I think both of us are saying like, you know, as long as there's no harm done, there's no wrong way to grieve.
Leah returned to North Carolina in the fall of 1999 and kept working toward her degree in anthropology and Spanish. Her studies abroad were part of her program, but they didn't offer the same amount of credits that staying on campus would. That meant that Leah had to hustle if she wanted to graduate on time the next year, but she seemed ready to work hard and make up for lost time.
However, in February of 2000, Leah mysteriously dropped out of school again. Her siblings tried to reason with her. Heath remembers telling her just to tough it out for 6 more months, but Leah didn't want to hear it. She didn't see why a degree had to stand between her and the rest of her life. She was still searching for a way to live differently, one that would feed her soul more than her mind. That's when Leah also started to pull away from her core group of friends. She spent all her time at Cup of Joe making new connections. One of them was a woman named Janine Quiller, who bonded with Leah over Jack Kerouac's novel, The Dharma Bums.
In the book, the main character, loosely based on Kerouac himself, heads out to Washington State to spend time on Desolation Peak in the Cascade Mountains. Leah talked with Janine about her desire to head west, to follow in Kerouac's footsteps, and spend time alone in the mountains, learning about herself. She started talking about taking a road trip, not just to Janine, but to her roommate Nicole as well. She even asked Nicole if she wanted to come along, but Nicole was busy working. She didn't have the money to just pick up and go.
But Leah could. She had no job, no classes, and she had inherited some money from her parents. So she decided to go alone.
I feel like traveling alone, especially cross-country as a woman, is a really, really scary and big thing to do. And I feel like it shouldn't be, which is also infuriating.
No, I totally agree. I recently just started doing solo trips with my dogs, not completely solo. And it was terrifying at first, especially my first one. I like overprepared. I brought all the things. I had the door locks. Like I was ready to go. And it's still scary.
It's scary because I feel like there are definitely predators out there that could target women who are traveling alone. And I feel like it's easy to do that because you're in an unfamiliar place. You don't have anybody with you that could help if something goes wrong. And then especially in this case where it took place in 2000, like this is before smartphones. So Leah didn't really have that ability to like share her location in real time.
Right. But, you know, I think as a solo female traveler, right, you can prepare for like your car breaking down, you know, for any incident like that and pretty much like get away with it. But what you can't prepare for is somebody watching you, somebody deciding that you're their next target. I think that's the scary part of travel. I'm not afraid of my car breaking down. I'm afraid of somebody seeing that I'm alone and taking advantage of that and trying to hurt me. And unfortunately, I don't think that that danger has gotten better or changed much over time, especially since, you know, Leah went missing.
You could even be like surrounded by a bunch of like strangers on your trip that appear really, really nice, like good Samaritans. But I personally have never taken like a solo road trip before. I don't know if I ever would. I feel like part of me like really wants to. It's like liberating. But another huge part of me is like so scared to do that.
That's what happened to me. I was like, no, like, I don't know if it's worth the risk. And then this other part of me was like, no, that's exactly why I'm going to do it because I shouldn't be afraid. Well, let me say, I should have a healthy amount of fear without it stopping me from doing what I want to do, like taking a road trip like anybody else.
So adding to the frustration, Leah doesn't tell anybody that she's planning to travel. So when Thursday, March 9th, 2000 rolls around, her friends and family don't suspect that anything is awry. Leah and Kara chat on the phone, as they often do. Not about anything in particular, the sisters just catch up. Leah casually mentions that she's available to hang out that weekend if Kara is too. Then, Leah makes plans with her roommate Nicole to babysit together for a neighbor the following day. When Nicole gets home from work that night, Leah isn't there. Nor is her 1993 white Jeep Cherokee or her cat, Bee. But that's not unusual. With their busy, ever-changing schedules, the roommates often go days without seeing each other, and Bee is often somewhere in hiding. But the next day, March 10th, Nicole shows up for their babysitting gig, while Leah does not. Nicole isn't worried, she's just disappointed. She figures that Leah forgot about their plans or found something more interesting to do on a Friday night. Without cell phones, Nicole can't exactly shoot Leah a text to check in. She figures she'll see Leah later that night and hear her excuse then.
But 2 days later, on Sunday, March 12th, there's still no sign of Leah, her car, or her cat. At this point, Nicole is concerned. She's getting calls from Leah's other friends, too, wondering why Leah bailed on their plans. That's when Nicole calls Kara. Turns out, she hasn't heard from her either. Nicole and Kara start reaching out to anyone in Leah's circle, but nobody knows anything. So they make a plan to meet again the next morning and strategize. By Monday, March 13th, no one's heard from Leah in 4 days. Kara goes to Nicole and Leah's house and heads directly for Leah's room. It's immediately clear to Kara that Leah left voluntarily. She took some clothes, toiletries, and cat litter. She'd clearly packed up for some sort of trip and took Bee with her. Nicole and Kara aren't sure what to do next. Solo trips aren't unlike Leah, but disappearing without a word is. They turn it over in their minds. She's dropped out of school against everyone's wishes. She's spending all day at coffee shops talking to strangers. Frankly, she seemed lost for quite a while. Maybe she's not thinking clearly. But neither woman says what they're both thinking. There's a big difference between lost and not okay. And right now, Kara and Nicole aren't sure which one they're dealing with. It's Monday, March 13th, 2000. 23-year-old Leah Roberts has been missing for 4 days. After taking a look through her bedroom, Leah's sister Kara and her roommate Nicole believe she left voluntarily, but they're concerned that Leah didn't tell anyone about her trip and that no one has heard from her since she left. Ultimately, Nicole and Kara decide to head over to the Raleigh police station and file a missing persons report. But because they don't know where Leah went, the authorities don't even know where to begin looking for her. However, the investigation is now officially open.
Cases like this are so difficult for me because I've heard time and time again from authorities that adults legally have the right to go missing or disappear if they want to. But I feel like in this case right now, they obviously didn't know where to like even begin looking for her because, you know, she kind of just left and there's kind of no clue where she could have gone. It's kind of hard because especially without like cell phone tracking or like any signs of foul play. I feel like police can really establish like where were they last seen? And then they can go from there.
I think my trouble with adults, you know, voluntarily, quote, going missing or whatever, is that it's so heavily opinion based. And whose opinion do you take? Is it the police, you know, who say that, you know, adults have a right to go missing if they want to? Or is it the family and her roommate who say that, you know, they think that something could be wrong? That's what's hard for me. And of course, like I'm always gonna, you know, err on the side of caution. If somebody comes to you and says, hey, my loved one appears to be missing, they've been gone for 4 days, it's just not like them because of these factors, I feel like that should be taken into consideration. And, you know, unfortunately, if it becomes a waste of resources, I feel like it's better safe than sorry.
I guess in my opinion, it's better to do too much than not enough, especially now 4 days have gone by and nobody's seen or heard from her. Like those first 4 days, those first hours are so crucial in finding out what happened.
Yeah, like it doesn't take much time and effort to put out a bolo, right? To be on the lookout so that, you know, if an officer pulls her over or encounters her in any way, they can just confirm that she's safe. I think, you know, it's just, it doesn't take that much to do a little bit of effort to bring somebody home.
Yeah, start with the people she's closest to, where she was last seen, where she could possibly be heading, like her favorite coffee place, you know, things like that. It's just like the small things that you can do when at first you don't know if foul play is suspected or not.
On Tuesday morning, March 14th, Kara returns to the apartment to take another look through Leah's room, hoping she missed something. And this time she finds it. On her dresser is a folded piece of paper. It's addressed to Nicole, with a Cheshire cat smile drawn on the outside. Inside is a wad of cash, along with a note in Leah's handwriting. It says the money's for rent while she's gone. Then Leah makes a couple requests. She asks Nicole to help with an upcoming Easter event and to give someone named Peter her laptop. She also wants Nicole to tell Kara not to worry, even though she knows she will. There's a PS about cookies in the freezer, and a suggestion that a friend named Melissa should come stay in Leah's room if she wants to visit Raleigh. And then, circled off to the side, there's something that neither Kara nor Nicole can totally decipher. A note referencing On the Road, with the date April 23rd written next to it, and Jack Kerouac's name spelled out phonetically, with a little smiley face next to the question mark. And there's another PS that reads, quote, "No, I'm not suicidal. I am the opposite." Kara can't stop looking at the Cheshire cat on the outside of the envelope. She knows Leah's a fan of Alice in Wonderland, but she wonders if the drawing means something more deliberate. The cat that disappears and reappears out of nowhere. The note seems to confirm what Kara and Nicole already suspected, though, that Leah left on her own terms and intends to come back. The money left behind for rent suggests she plans to be gone for a month max. The note seems happy. Leah seems happy, and she said it herself. She's not suicidal. But Kara, who has always looked after her little sister, can't let go of the worry. She needs to know where Leah is, and she's not sure if the note holds any more clues to that question.
The note doesn't really seem suspicious. Kind of like in their words, like she seems happy. She doesn't seem like anything is really wrong. But on one hand, it's kind of like ambiguous. I don't know. Like it could kind of be split down the middle for me. It could be her not having anything wrong and she's kind of just doodling and like leaving a little note saying she'll be back soon. On the other hand, she could be leaving, I guess, like little Easter eggs hinting at what she's like about to do. No matter how ambiguous a clue or a piece of evidence might be, I do feel like investigators should look into it with as many resources as possible because you never know.
Yeah, I mean, you can only do like what you can with what you have, right? And I think, you know, if Leah had been gone for 2 days, left this note and came back, nobody would be overanalyzing it like we are right now. But because it's one of the biggest pieces of evidence we have in this case, of course, we're going to microanalyze everything. And then add that extra layer of being close to Leah, right? Her family, her roommate, her friends. I'm sure that they've picked this over in their minds like a million times. And it could mean everything, or it could mean absolutely nothing, especially the Cheshire cat.
I know. I feel like that's kind of what throws me for a loop a little bit, because I feel like the note itself is not like suspicious at all. But then that drawing of the cat, you know, the cat is known to like reappear and disappear. I feel like that holds so much weight in this case specifically.
Right. I mean, but you could attribute like anything to the Cheshire cat in terms of like the Alice in Wonderland lore, right? There's so much more than him just like fading in and out. And again, do we know if she liked to doodle? Could have just been a doodle. I don't have any of the answers to these questions. But again, I have to imagine that this has been mulled over in the minds of investigators, her family, everybody who knew her, millions of people who have heard her story. And at the end of the day, it seems like we just don't know.
I agree. And then especially with like the references to on the road, probably in their minds, they're probably trying to rationalize like her absence, you know, relating to like road trips and stuff. But yeah, I feel like the not knowing is probably just so tough.
And I get it. You know, they want to try to figure it out and find the answers. I totally get it.
After scrutinizing Leah's note all morning, something dawns on Kara. When Leah went to Costa Rica, she'd given Kara power of attorney, which means Kara still has access to her financial records and can see if Leah's been using her ATM card anywhere along her trip. So after going to the bank, Kara learns Leah withdrew $3,000 in cash on March 9th, the last day she was heard from. Her debit card was then used about 730 miles away at a hotel near Memphis, Tennessee on March 10th. Then again at a few gas stations as she made her way west over the following days. The last transaction on record is from just before 1 a.m. on March 13th at a gas station convenience store in Brooks, Oregon.
Now, Kara has no idea why Leah would be headed out west, until she and Nicole start reaching out to people in Leah's life. That includes Janine, her new friend from Cup of Joe. And when they talk to her, a picture starts to emerge. She tells them she and Leah bonded over Kerouac's novel, The Dharma Bums, which is set at Desolation Peak in Washington State. She says she's positive that's where Leah is heading. She'd told Janine that she wanted to go sit alone in the mountains and figure out what really matters, and that she wanted to learn more about herself. It all points to one thing. Leah's disappearance was her choice. She told a friend she wanted to do some soul searching in Washington State, Kerouac style. She left a note saying she wasn't suicidal, that Kara shouldn't worry. She was an adult, her own person. So why did everything still feel so wrong?
Well, Kara tries to let it go and allow some time to pass. Her birthday is only 5 days away on March 19th. And Kara is certain that if all is well with her sister, she'll get a call from Leah to wish her a happy 26th birthday. But when the 19th rolls around, Kara doesn't get a call from Leah. Instead, she gets a message asking her to contact the Whatcom County Sheriff's Department in Bellingham, Washington. When she returns the call, the authorities tell her something that makes her heart sink. The day before, on Saturday, March 18th, two hikers were making their way up a mountain road in the Mount Baker National Forest, about 30 miles east of Bellingham. As they walked, one of them happened to glance down into a ravine and spotted something. A car. It was wrecked at the bottom of a steep embankment off a remote logging road. And when he made his way down to get a closer look, he saw it was a white Jeep Cherokee with North Carolina plates. But there was no one inside. The hiker called 911, and a deputy from the Whatcom County Sheriff's Department responded to the scene. At first, it seemed like it could have been a drunk driving incident. But when the deputy ran the plates and connected the Jeep to the missing persons report that had been filed in Raleigh 5 days earlier, the authorities knew they were dealing with something a lot more complicated. Based on the damage done to the trees on the way down, the Jeep had probably been traveling between 30 and 40 miles per hour when it went over the embankment. It appeared to have rolled multiple times before crashing at the bottom. An accident at that speed, with that kind of roll, should have left someone badly injured. But there was no blood inside the vehicle, no sign that the seatbelt had been strained. Really, there was zero indication that anyone had been inside the car when it crashed, which was baffling. The only signs that someone had been there at all were the personal items strewn about the area, including Leah's checkbook, her guitar, some CDs, and bags of clothing. Plus, there were blankets and pillows covering the blown-out windows, which suggested that someone may have used the Jeep as a shelter after the crash. The scene left investigators with more questions than answers. What had made the car drive off the road? How did it happen? Did someone else find it and use it as shelter, or was it the driver? And most importantly, where was Leah Roberts?
As soon as Kara hangs up with the Whatcom Sheriff's Department, she calls her brother Heath. The siblings decide to fly out to Washington State to go look for their sister. Meanwhile, investigators continue to search for Leah's car for any other clues as to her whereabouts, and they discover a couple of items that help flesh out Leah's journey. The first is a gas receipt from a store in Brooks, Oregon, where Leah had stopped to fill up at about 12:50 a.m. on March 13th, 4 days after she left home. When Kara and Heath arrive in Washington, Kara confirms this was the charge she'd already seen on Leah's bank statement.
Investigators contact the Brooks gas station and request their security footage from that night. It shows Leah inside the store, alone, paying at the register. She looks calm, but at one point, while she's waiting for the clerk to ring her up, she turns and peers out the door toward the parking lot. Then she does a double take and looks again. Unfortunately, we may never know what she was looking at, since the cameras outside the store weren't working. This is another frustrating aspect to this case, where they have like this last known footage of her, and at first it's also kind of like ambiguous. She looks fine, she doesn't look frantic, like anything's wrong, but she is peering out, kind of doing double takes into this parking lot where the cameras are just so happen not working.
Right, I mean, why are the cameras always not working? I would love to talk about that, right, and get a real answer to that. But I feel like all this does is confirm where she was and when she was there. I think that the double take out the door could have been anything. She could have seen somebody that she thought she knew. She could have saw a car that she liked. I mean, it could have been absolutely anything, which I know isn't the most exciting for like a true crime brain. You know what I mean? But I think sometimes the reality of true crime is that there's not always something more to it. There could be, but we don't have any guarantee of that. I feel like I keep saying it could be everything or it could be nothing.
Not everything is conspiracy theory or something big. It could have just been her doing a double take into the parking lot because she just wanted to see what was out there. But honestly, I feel like sometimes the not knowing in cases like these is almost worse than having answers.
Yeah, it's like the Cheshire Cat, right? It's something that you could sit there and think about and think of all the, you know, a million possibilities of what it could be. And I think that's some of the hardest things for families. You know, I know for a lot of families I work with, for me, like if you look at it enough and if you just try hard enough, you might be able to pick a clue out of it that'll help find your loved one.
Well, let's go back to Leah's car for a second, because another significant item they find there is a movie ticket to American Beauty, if you're wondering. It was bought at a theater in Bellingham on the afternoon of March 13th for the 2:10 p.m. showing. So if Leah drove straight from Brooks to Bellingham, it would have taken about 5.5 hours, which means she would have had plenty of time to spare before the movie started if she left around 1 a.m. So investigators begin to wonder what she did in that window of time and who she talked to, if anyone.
Meanwhile, Kara and Heath print up some missing persons posters and head to Bellingham on March 23rd. They put up posters in the Bellis Fair Mall where the movie theater is located, hoping to find someone who knows something about Leah. When Kara sees the only sit-down restaurant in that mall, a place called Elephant and Castle, she guesses that Leah would have gone there for a meal, either before or after the movie. She and Heath leave some flyers at the restaurant and hope for the best. Then they reluctantly head home to North Carolina. After these last 4 days in Washington, Leah's siblings are leaving with almost no new information on their sister's whereabouts. To say they're disappointed is an understatement.
But the next day, there's a sliver of hope. Someone calls into the police station with a tip. He says Leah had been at Elephant and Castle on the 13th, and she'd been talking. It's March 24th, 2000. A man, who we'll call Joe, sees Leah's missing persons flyer at Elephant and Castle and calls investigators to tell them something important. He'd spoken to Leah there on the afternoon of March 13th, 4 days after she'd left home. Joe says she sat between him and another man at the bar. She was warm and chatty with both of them, talking about her road trip and Jack Kerouac. He says she then left the restaurant alone. Investigators then track down the second man who was seated on the other side of Leah at the bar. We'll call him Steve. His account matches Joe's in most respects. He remembers Leah, confirms that she was friendly and talkative and very into Kerouac. But when it comes to how the afternoon ended, Steve's story is a bit different. According to him, Leah didn't leave the restaurant alone. She left with a third man, one he referred to only as Barry. Steve says that he doesn't know anything about Barry, but he remembers what he looked like. His description is detailed enough that police bring in a sketch artist. And now, they finally have the face of a possible person of interest in Leah's disappearance. They release the sketch to the media right away.
Unfortunately, no one seems to recognize the man from the sketch. Plus, investigators have another eyewitness who says Leah definitely left alone. And when police speak to others who were at the restaurant that afternoon, no one can confirm this Barry was ever there at all. Detectives begin to suspect that Steve invented the story about Barry, but they aren't sure why.
Sarah, what do you think about this Barry guy? Do you think he's real? I mean, I feel like there's so many people saying that he wasn't there at all, like that he doesn't exist.
I think it's hard, right? But when you don't know and you don't have video footage, it's a game of what do the most people say? I think that's the most reliable way to figure out, especially like this situation. If you have one person saying that this Barry guy was there and you have 10 other people saying that didn't happen, I'm going to trust the 10 other people.
Yeah, I feel like I have to kind of lean with the detectives on this, that maybe Steve did just kind of make this story up. At the end of the day, there's probably a million different reasons why somebody would fabricate something like this. But I think what it boils down to, you know, if this account is not true, is probably just attention and boredom. I mean, people want to insert themselves in these high profile cases. But then part of me is like, no, you always want to err on the side of caution. And honestly, I don't feel like what they did in releasing the sketch to the public was wrong by any means, even if it could potentially be like not true, because at the very least, like it's going to get people talking about the case.
Well, and I feel like unless you can rule it out 100%, you still need to keep that door open. Again, you can have all these people saying one thing and this guy saying another. And until you can say for sure, why not just leave it as a maybe, even if it's like a likely not?
I really don't think it would hurt, honestly.
Yeah, because I mean, who knows? If they find another clue and it looks just like the sketch of Barry, then you have something there. Still, the local police continue looking into the mysterious Barry. Meanwhile, the Whatcom Sheriff's Department and the FBI do a more thorough sweep of Leah's car, which has been towed to a safe facility to process evidence. On March 30th, 12 days after Leah's Jeep was discovered, and almost 3 weeks after Leah left North Carolina, officers find a few other items of importance in her car. Tucked into a pair of pants is a wad of cash, $2,400 to be exact. Leah had withdrawn $3,000. As far as they knew, she'd only spent money on gas, food, and a movie ticket. If she was planning on continuing her trip without her car, she'd need money to survive. So why leave this behind? Then, under a floor mat in the Jeep, officers discover a diamond ring. It was Leah's mother's engagement ring, and it's widely known to be Leah's most prized possession. Her friends and family confirm that she never took this ring off. For them, this is the greatest indicator that Leah has been met with foul play. At this point, most people feel like something horrible has happened to Leah, but no one can prove it. The crash site and the car have been combed, witnesses have been questioned, but the authorities still have nothing. That's when Leah's case runs cold, and it stays that way for 7 more years.
In 2007, Leah's case is passed on to new detectives in the Bellingham Police Department. They re-examine the evidence and notice something startling. Even though the interior of the car had been thoroughly searched, no one had ever looked under the hood. When the detectives pry it open, they find an explanation for one of the big, lingering questions in this case. If no one had been in the car when it rolled down into the ravine, how had it gotten there? Well, it turns out the Jeep had been tampered with. The cover on the starter relay had been removed, and it had been rewired so that someone could start the car from the outside and cause it to accelerate on its own, without anyone behind the wheel. Meaning, Leah's car crash wasn't an accident, and it wasn't random. Whoever had done this to her car had to have significant mechanical knowledge to make their plan work, knowledge Leah didn't have. So the police processed the car one more time. And as luck would have it, on the inner underside of the hood, they find a series of fingerprints that were never documented during the original investigation.
With this new information, investigators turn their attention back to that witness, Steve, the man from Elephant and Castle, the man who claimed Leah left with someone named Barry. And as it turns out, Steve does have experience as a mechanic, as well as experience in the military. Between that and his strange, possibly false report of this Barry guy, Steve officially becomes a person of interest. Washington authorities track him down and find out he's currently living in Canada. They contact the local police there and request that he be fingerprinted and provide a DNA sample. They also send the other clothing items found from the car to be checked for a lingering DNA. Unfortunately, this is where the investigation hits another snag. It takes them 2 years to obtain the fingerprints and DNA from Steve, and to get the DNA checked from the rest of the clothing.
I mean, 2 years is definitely a long time to, you know, wait for samples and to kind of collect evidence like this, but I guess when you are collecting and like obtaining this DNA from another country, I'm sure there's like a whole list of like steps that you have to follow. But you know, it does suck because when a suspect, especially like Steve, kind of knows that they're being looked at, I feel like it works in their favor a little bit, in his favor. I don't know, it could help him possibly dispose of evidence if there is any left.
Yeah, I mean, I get it, right? I don't know what that looks like internationally, but I think I'm a little less forgiving of that. 2 years seems absolutely unacceptable to me. And to your point, you know, as long as he knows he's a person of interest, that they're looking at him trying to obtain these things, then he has 2 years to dispose of evidence. Like, that drives me crazy. And we know, we've seen cases that are fresh, brand new, with a ton of media coverage. And what happens to their DNA? They find out like in a matter of days, like sometimes the same day. These things can be done. I understand that there's a backlog that, you know, of course going internationally is going to complicate things, but 2 years is too long.
The ball was kind of dropped in this case. Like, that's a long time.
Yeah, and I get it, right? You know, I think a lot of listeners know that I was on the board of Season of Justice, you know, who provides funding for law enforcement for exactly this, for DNA testing, because we know that their budgets aren't unlimited. But again, it just tells me that they don't care. It wasn't made a priority. And that's the sad, I think, fact of this.
Yeah, and he was kind of already like a little bit suspicious to begin with this fake story. And I mean, we've seen this time and time again, too, where people insert themselves into the investigation, kind of, you know, lie and make like these false claims. And usually, I mean, I don't know 100% in this case here, but like usually they're hiding something. And then, you know, add on another 2 years when they're looking at him as a suspect, like that's just ridiculous.
Yeah, and this feels like very direct evidence, right? His fingerprints underneath the hood of this car that's crashed. It's not like some ambiguous, maybe we'll connect him in some other way. If it's his fingerprints, he's likely involved in this. And that gives him 2 years to, again, like commit other crimes too. It's just, it's too long. I don't find it acceptable in any way.
But, you know, DNA testing and technology, it has changed dramatically since 2000. So I don't know. I feel like there is still a really good chance that all of the evidence collected in 2000, it could be tested again today and it could yield different results just because of how much things have improved. So I guess there's always that aspect.
Unfortunately, the exact reason for the delay in this particular case has never been thoroughly explained. And in an even more frustrating twist, when they finally do get the samples from Steve, they aren't a match. For a case that's already been waiting years for answers, this must have felt like a huge letdown. But in the spring of 2010, it seemed like a new door had opened. A crime lab finally identifies male DNA on an item left behind in Leah's car. But again, unfortunately, that DNA has never been matched to anyone, or proven useful in any way.
But 4 years later, in 2014, another kernel of hope surfaces. The authorities discover a mummified body in the same region where Leah's Jeep was found. The similarities are striking. The estimated height matches Leah's. The remains even have a metal rod in the right femur. It's from a batch shipped in the fall of 1998, the same year Leah had her rod implanted. For a moment, it seems like Leah's body has finally been found. But experts ultimately determine the remains likely belong to a male. Man, I feel like in this case, like the years just keep going on, and like every so often, there's like this little nugget of like hope when like something like this brand new piece of evidence emerges. you know, you have the whole Steve thing. In 2010, they found out it's not him. They can kind of like put that to rest a little bit. And then another 4 years later, a mummified body is found, you know, not hoping, but considering it could possibly be her, only to find out that it's not. I'm sure that has to be so tough to deal with. You're already missing your loved one. And then like the decades just like stretch out and then like your hope constantly just gets crushed.
Yeah. I mean, every family takes these things differently, right? And I never want to speak for anybody who's not present with us. But I can say that it's like bittersweet. You're constantly reopening this wound that you have for this ambiguous loss, right? Because we don't know what happened. But at the same time, you still want those leads to come in. Of course, you know, I have to imagine that her family, her loved ones want the case to progress. But yeah, it hurts every single time, I'm sure. I know it does for me. I know it does for so many families. So again, it's like this double-edged sword. You want the case to progress. You want these tips to come in.
I feel like that level of hope that you have at the very beginning, I just feel like it never goes away. It could be 10 days from now, 10 years from now, 20 years from now. Like you always have this tremendous hope that this will be resolved. And I don't feel like that changes.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's different for everybody, right? I've worked with families who've held out hope, that same level of hope from the beginning and 30 years later. You know, some families 30 years later, they say, you know, I just don't think it's likely anymore. I want it to be likely and I hope it happens, but like the levels change a little bit. So it's really difficult because I think it's just different for everybody. We're all different humans with different standards and levels of tolerance for things like this. Which is why some families you'll see just like walk away. It just hurts too much. Like they're always there and open for investigators. But in terms of, you know, being forward facing in the media, being the family contact person, sometimes families do just have to step away and I respect it. 25 years later, Leah's family and friends are still waiting. Every lead that surfaces and then fades is its own kind of loss. The question still hasn't changed. What happened to Leah? The honest answer is that we don't know. But here's what we're sure of. On the morning of Thursday, March 9th, 2000, 23-year-old Leah Roberts called her sister, made plans with her roommate, and wrote a cryptic note to her roommate, Nicole, which included a message to her sister. Then she went to the bank and withdrew $3,000 in cash. Sometime that evening, she got into her white Jeep Cherokee, packed with clothes, books, and other sentimental items, including her cat Bee, and left. She drove through the night and into the next day. On the night of March 10th, she crossed into Tennessee and checked into a hotel near Memphis. After that, Leah kept moving. She quickly made her way through the middle of the country, and then up to the Pacific Northwest. She traveled nearly 3,000 miles in 4 days. By the early hours of March 13th, she'd made it all the way to Brooks, Oregon, where she stopped at a gas station. She paid for her gas, turned and looked back at the parking lot for just a moment. Then she got back in her Jeep and kept driving. A few hours later, she arrived in Bellingham, Washington, where she went to the movies and had a meal at Elephant and Castle. She was warm, she was talkative. She spoke to the strangers beside her about Jack Kerouac and why she'd come all this way. She seemed happy, like someone who knew exactly where they wanted to be. And then she disappeared.
We don't know what happened after she walked out of that restaurant on the afternoon of March 13th, but we do know her Jeep ended up at the bottom of an embankment. We know her mother's ring was under the floor mat and most of her cash was still in her pants. We know that someone tampered with the engine of her car, and we know that Leah was never seen again. She was 23 years old. She had survived the loss of both of her parents, a near-fatal car accident, and more grief than most people face in a lifetime, and she had gotten back up every single time. She was on her way to Desolation Peak in Washington State to sit alone in the mountains and figure out what came next, but it seems like she never made it. Leah Toby Roberts would be 50 years old as of this recording. She's described as a white woman, approximately 5 feet 6 inches tall, with light brown hair and blue eyes. She has a metal rod in her right femur from a car accident in 1998. She was last seen in Bellingham, Washington on March 13th, 2000. If you have any information about Leah Roberts, please contact the Whatcom County Sheriff's Office in Washington State at 360-778-6600 or visit NamUs.gov for more information.
Thank you for listening to The Final Hours. If you have any more information on Leah Roberts, please share it with us on social media. We want to hear from you. Your thoughts, condolences, and feedback are what make this community so special.
At Crime House, we value your support. Share your thoughts on social media and remember to rate, review, and follow The Final Hours to help others discover the show. Thanks for listening.
And to enhance your listening experience, subscribe to Crime House Plus on Apple Podcasts. You'll get every episode of The Final Hours ad-free, along with early access and exciting bonus content.
The Final Hours is hosted by Sarah Turney and me, Courtney Nicole, and is a Crime House original powered by Pave Studios. This episode was brought to life by The Final Hours team: Max Cutler, Ron Shapiro, Alex Benadon, Lori Marinelli, Natalie Pertzowski, Sarah Camp, Ellie Reed, Leah Roche, and Russell Nash. Thank you for listening.